So do you know, when I first started in this 30-odd years ago, I think there was about six books on creationists, on creation, and you can see just that's just a sample of the resources we have today. And in fact, I think in all the years that I've been involved in ministry, the current period we're in is the most exciting time ever to be a Bible-believing Christian, particularly in this area. We have so much information to support what we believe. And the next area I'm going to show you in the area of dinosaurs, I think, is one of the most exciting areas. And I talked about kind of losing our children to the, if you like, to the promotion of these evolutionary ideas, particularly when it challenges those early chapters in Genesis. And dinosaurs are certainly one of those things, because they're often, well, not often, pretty much always presented in the secular realm within the framework of millions of years. So to understand the kind of the big picture, give or take a few million years, is there was a great age of dinosaurs that started about 300 million years ago, and the last dinosaur died out about 65 million years ago, and they evolved into birds. So I'm going to show you some exciting stuff today. And also in the area of genetics is the other very, very exciting area. Darwin, obviously a man of his day. Oh, we're flickering again. It's only that one over there. Knew nothing about genetics. We are still uncovering mysteries of the genome as part of the genetic revolution. In fact, a gentleman who sits in an office right next to me, Dr. Robert Carter, and Dr. John Sanf, who I mentioned, the inventor of the gene gun. They're working on, if you like, the creationist interpretation of the Human Genome Project. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in this particular talk as well. So one of the confusions about dinosaurs comes from the fact you don't see the word dinosaur in the Bible. And so again, I've seen all sorts of ideas that Christians come up with. Well, you know, maybe Satan created the dinosaur fossils in the rocks to confuse people. And the reason we do that is because we think that, you know, there's that stigma of millions of years associated with dinosaurs. But dinosaurs did exist. We have their fossils, and they're really just wonderful, a wonderful part, I believe, of God's creation. They're not around today. In fact, we wrote an article earlier this year. I know some of you have been reading some of the stuff by other well-meaning Christians and creationists, and they're off to expeditions in the Congo to look for Mekele and Mbebe. You know, we might have thought that 30, 40 years ago, but we have pretty much explored just about every inch of this planet. And we have satellites up there mapping and looking, and I tell you, if they found one, I think they would actually tell us. I don't think there's any great conspiracy going on to hide that. So where do we place dinosaurs within the biblical framework? Well, on day six of creation, it says God made all the land animals and man. Now, notice he doesn't say horses and dogs. It's land animals or creatures that move along the ground. Day five, he made the sea and the flying creatures. It doesn't say birds. So you presume he made the pteranodons, pterodactyls, etc. also on day five. The word is uf, or Hebrew there, creatures that flew in the air. And so again, when we look at our world, we take the biblical worldview of creation about 6,000 years ago, no death before the fall, so you can't have dinosaurs roaming around millions of years before Adam and Eve. There's the relevant passage, by the way, Genesis 1:25. God made the wild animals according to their kind, the livestock according to their kind, creatures that move along the ground according to their kind, and God saw that it was good. And so creatures that move along the ground must include what we call dinosaurs. Now, I want to talk about, again, some of the urban legends that we've come to believe about dinosaurs. And we watch movies like Jurassic Park and everything else, and this is where some of those cultural influences come from. But we think about them being these ferocious meat eaters because typically they have, a lot of them had these very sharp teeth. In fact, there's an illustration there that shows you T-Rex actually had serrated edges on his teeth. So immediately you see that, you think, wow, that must have been used for meat eating, right? Slicing open carcasses and other things like that. But check this out. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but see this skull? I'll tell you a couple of things about it. These pointy fangs at the front here, maybe I could reason that they were used for kind of grabbing hold of its prey, you know, locking it in place until it dies. And then these side cutters here are so sharp. Do you know, you could actually slice a piece of paper with them. They're so sharp. So maybe they get used, you know, for sawing off lumps of flesh and something like that. And I won't do it today, but usually if I'm in schools, I'll say, so boys and girls, what do you think that's the creature? Or what sort of creature it is? And I get, you know, saber-toothed tiger and dog and wolf and all sorts of stuff. Why? Well, because I just misled them. It's actually the skull of a fruit bat. But I make a point there. Remember I said earlier, creationists, evolutionists, we have the same facts. So we have a skull with sharp teeth. How do I know what it eats? Well, in this case, these things used to flap around in my back garden in Brisbane, nibbling my papayas to see whether they were ripe or not. But when you find fossils in the ground, you see sharp teeth. The interpretation is always that they are a carnivore. Not always the case, though. I mean, we do find fossilized dung and so on, so you can determine what some creatures eat. But here's an example of how people are misled by the design of teeth being used for meat eating. So outside of Taronga Zoo in Sydney, Australia, our most famous zoo, it's an Aboriginal word, Taronga, although bears have designed for eating meat, their diet consists mainly of plants. That was the sign outside of the bear exhibit. Can you see something wrong with that? Bears have teeth designed for eating meat, but what do they actually see it eat? Plants. So is it a herbivore or a carnivore? It's a herbivore, isn't it? It has sharp teeth. See, I'm sure some of you ate dead pig for breakfast this morning. Anybody have bacon? Okay, so you ate meat, but your teeth are really not the teeth that, you know, were designed what people think are for carnivory. See, we go back to Genesis 3, there was a fall. Death entered the world. Animals started predating upon one another. And so even when we think about things like dinosaurs, it tells us in Genesis that humans, that every herb and fruit and, you know, kind of vegetables were given to us for food, it actually says, and the animals also. Now, we do see animals today, we think that they have specialized diets and they have to have, you know, meat to survive, etc. That's a bit of an urban legend. There's been lots of examples of giant cats being kept in zoos and so on and so forth. In fact, on Creation Magazine, we've had the lion that wouldn't eat meat, actually even refused a drop of blood in its formula milk, etc. And it survived quite healthily, etc. We're going to see through selection and environment, creatures can change their diets. I remember years ago watching a Richard Attenborough documentary where it was shocking, where chimpanzees were herding up, I think they were little colobus monkeys, chasing them up trees, and there were chimps up the trees, you may have seen that, waiting for them, and they grabbed hold of these little monkeys and smashed their skulls on the tree branches and ate their brains live. But hang on, chimps are actually herbivores, aren't they? So they learnt something new, and obviously it gets passed on. So in fact, all creation, all the animals were originally designed to be vegetarian. And the name dinosaur, yes, you don't see it in the Bible because it's a modern word. It was invented by this scientist called Sir Richard Owen, and he found the bones of a megasaur and a guanodon. And dinosaur is actually a Greek word which means terrible lizard, fearsome lizard, something like that. They believe they were looking at kind of giant reptiles, and that's where the name come from. So when I say modern word, I mean you don't see the word laptop in the Bible, right? We invent words all the time. And, of course, as I said earlier, the fossil record contains dinosaur bones, but not as many as people think. In fact, in all the world's museums, you've probably only got a couple of thousand really decent, partially complete dinosaur skeletons. We have billions of fossils, but most of them, around about 97, 98%, I'm not sure what the figures are today, are overwhelmingly fossils that are marine creatures, typically creatures that lived and dwelled on the ocean floor, lots of algae and sponges and so on. And I think that's consistent with what we see from a global flood. Because, you know, when you see that geologic column, right, and you see those creatures that live on the ocean floor and we get up and then we start to get to the vertebrates, we have the amphibians and then we have the vertebrates like humans and mammals at the top. Well, when you look at that, it's a little misleading because we think that that's an equal distribution of the fossils through the record. In fact, when you think about it, 98% of that geologic column by volume are the creatures that live on the ocean floor. And the Bible tells us that the flood started in the in the fountains of the great deep. We believe that means it started in the oceans. And so there would have been huge tsunamis and earthquakes as that original supercontinent ripped apart. We can fit it back together. We do believe, a lot of creationists believe there was one supercontinent. And it wasn't continental drift, it was continental sprint. It's been modeled. There's a whole chapter in the Answers book where it's modeled on a Cray supercomputer at Los Alamos University in the United States, where they had the continents moving apart at 150 feet a second. So cast your mind back to, say, thinking about that tsunami off the coast of Japan a few years ago. You can go on YouTube and you can see a fishing trawler on the ocean. They saw the tsunami wave coming, but it was just a swell, and they rode the swell. But as the water shallows out, what happens? The wave reaches destructive height. And when the water inundated the land, anybody remember the color of the water? Well, it wasn't nice, clear seawater. It was black. Why? Because it had picked up sediments as it traveled along the ocean, right, at hurricane speed, cyclonic speed, you know, over 100 miles an hour moving across the ocean. So think about all those creatures that lived on the ocean floor. What would happen to them? Going to get buried in silt and mud. But when the water hits the lands, which is where primarily most of the vertebrates live, we're not necessarily going to get buried. We're going to drown. We're going to float and rot and bloat and maybe get eaten by other predators. So that's what I mean when I think I see the fossil record. I think it's consistent with some of the models that could be formulated for the flood. Okay, and again, it's not evidence of millions of years. In the fossil record, we find dinosaurs predating upon other dinosaurs, and we even find fossilized tumors here from the Discovery Center, x-raying a tumor on a sauropod. A sauropod is one of those dinosaurs with a long neck and a long tail. Okay. And they're saying, hey, cancer's been around for millions of years. It's no different to cancer we see today. So again, could you have cancer in the fossil record before Adam and Eve and God calling it very, very good? There are theological problems with that. One of the reasons we're fascinated with dinosaurs is some of them were just magnificently large beasts. Our mind wonders what it would be like to kind of see them today. But in fact, from out of all the fossils they found, I was reading an article, a secular article not so long ago, and they kind of reasoned that the mean size or the average size of the dinosaurs is probably about the size of a small pony, something like that. Now, some grew to be very, very large, but did you know some were actually very, very small? This guy here, Compsognathus, was actually as small as a chicken. Can you imagine that? So I often say we were going to stop off for KFD last night, but if these guys were still around, it probably would have been KFD, yeah. It's KFC, not KFD, right, all right. But all dinosaurs, even the very, very big ones, all started off as eggs. And for years, they thought the eggs were only about the size of a football. We have actually found some larger eggs, but there's a biological limit to egg size, because of the thickness of the shell and allowing the embryo to breathe, etc. But the point here is, even these great big dinosaurs were originally once small. And obviously they grew to be the enormous size that we see today. And some of them are massive. I mean, the most popular plane in the world is the 737, the modern derivation, actually the MAX, but the one before that, the 900. And you can see that some of these dinosaurs are nearly as long as the 737. I mean, that's pretty big, isn't it? Pretty big. And every year they come up with a new candidate for the largest one. You know, there was one called Seismosaurus, which literally meant earth-shaking lizard. They got this guy now, Amphicelius. They think he's the larger one. But notice how these giant sauropods, they all look fairly similar, don't they? See, what happened in the late 1800s was something called the Bone Wars. And they discovered these new creatures. Richard Owen named them dinosaurs. And scientists were going all over the world, and they were digging up fragments of fossils. And they said, well, this one looks a little bit like this one. I'll give you an example. See, here are some variations. They're called species of dinosaurs. But notice they're very similar. Now, Amphicelius, all they found there was a piece of vertebrae. But they say, well, that's very similar to the vertebrae of these other ones. So they can figure out that it's a sauropod, but given that it's much larger, they'll give it a different species name. Keep that in mind, okay? There are all these different species. In fact, there's been a revolution in dinosaur paleontology, even from a secular point of view, that I'm going to show you in a moment. And we can learn a lot, again, from the fossils. You know, as I said, nature works against preservation. Here's another fast fossil. Obviously, he didn't take millions of years to eat his lunch. Dr. Taz Walker, our staff geologist in Australia, photographed this piece of fossilized dinosaur skin. Look at the detail. You can see the creases and the bumps and the nodules in place, right? So again, preservation, it's an indication, buried quickly. Okay, didn't lie around for millions of years. In Australia's Dinosaur Museum in Canberra, again, remember I showed you in the first talk the story of how they say fossils form. This is pictures in the Dinosaur Museum. Dinosaur sinks to the ocean floor and dies. And while he lies there, guess what? He gets covered by sediments. The sediments, the layers, are where the millions of years comes from. He gets permineralized, and then later we dig him up, or for some reason he gets uncovered. But you know, I showed you a fossilized hat that could occur very quickly. Here's another one. This was actually a leather hat buried in a mine in Tasmania. And within 50 years, it's become completely permineralized. So, you know, we obviously see a lot of dinosaur fossils. We believe in flood deposited rock. But we also see lots of dinosaur specimens that we believe are post-flood. That means they survived the flood. How did they do that? Well, the only way you're going to survive the flood is to be on Noah's Ark. That's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Keep that in mind as we go along. But here's some of the scientific evidence we have. And I believe this directly refutes the evolutionary paradigm of millions of years for dinosaurs. Now, friend, not to challenge you, but challenged me a while ago to say that science is self-correcting. It is within our models. Even creationists do that. Creationists have models that we know are now not tenable. Years ago, they used to think there's a water vapor canopy over the earth. It's been modeled. We have temperatures now of 1,000 degrees when we tried to do that. And we know that the age of the patriarchs was not created by some super atmosphere prior to the flood, because we find amber, fossilized amber. We can take air out of the amber, and the pre-flood air is no different to the air that we have today. All right? We now know the age of the patriarchs is probably genetics, because there was a genetic bottleneck at the flood. We know about things called genetic entropy, that where mutations are increasing in the population. But look at this. This is one of the first discoveries. You're looking at a blood vessel there from a Tyrannosaurus rex leg bone. And those red dots there are unfossilized blood cells. Now remember I said the last dinosaur died out 65 million years ago. Mary Schweitzer, the scientist, discovered that. Here's some of her latest discoveries. She's an evolutionist, by the way. You're looking here. By the way, this is from Science magazine. It's not some creationist publication. Ligament, flesh, blood vessels, more red blood cells. On PBS, that's a public service station, documentary. We actually featured in our documentary, Evolution's Achilles Heels. They're pulling it apart. You can see it's stretchy. Stretched and returned to its original shape. Now, to be honest, does that sound like 65 million-year-old material to you? She said, when you think about it, the laws of chemistry and biology and everything else that we know say that it should be gone. It should be degraded completely. Everything else that we know, she's saying that. But guess what? We say it's self-correcting, but they still think those samples are millions of years old. Why? Because that's the paradigm. That's in place. That's what we're taught. That age of dinosaurs, 300 to 65 million years ago. Here's another example, unfossilized hadrosaur skin. A hadrosaur is a theropod dinosaur, ones that stand on the hind leg. He's asked the question, how the fossil remained intact for 70 million years? See, the paradigm doesn't change. And in fact, what they're doing now, and we've got dozens of examples like this, by the way. This is just a handful I'm showing you. Dozens of examples. They're now looking for it. So very intelligent scientists are working in laboratories trying to develop concoctions, iron-rich solutions, they believe, that could preserve dinosaur tissue for millions of years. Actually, wouldn't it be easier just to believe they're not millions of years old? But hang on, guess what that would do? Challenges the paradigm, ladies and gentlemen. So respectfully, in that respect, science is not self-correcting within the paradigm. Okay? Think about it. Intelligent scientists developing concoctions with all that equipment, all that technology, and that this is supposed to occur randomly in nature all over the world to preserve it. Doesn't really kind of fit, doesn't it, the chances of that. And here's something that even surprised creationists, which was unfossilized DNA. They found DNA in the bone cells of a T-Rex. Because we've reasoned, even under the most perfect conditions where you freeze it, even if you freeze it, it'll eventually break down, you could only get a maximum age of around about 40,000 years. But the last dinosaur died out 65 million years ago, according to the paradigm. Why is this significant? Well, we have these little, every time our cells reproduce, we carry these letter mistakes, mutations, but we have these wonderful machines that come in and try to repair it. Now, they don't get them all, which is eventually the reason we die. But what happens, by the way, is a chicken and egg problem. The instructions for the machines to repair the DNA are actually on the DNA. So which came first? Okay, obviously it had to be there, fully functional the first time it appeared. But once death occurs, the machinery stops working. So DNA is basically just a chemical molecule and it breaks down very, very quickly. Very, very quickly. So as I said, this was even a surprise for creationists. So it's an indication, obviously, dinosaurs lived until actually quite recently. Yeah, my last trip here, it was my fourth trip, I actually took a week off at the end and had a vacation. I went to Kruger, right, did what every tourist does. I remember our guide took us round to this pool and he said, I want to show you this, guys. He says, 3 days ago I drove around here. He said, the lions had just killed this big buffalo, water buffalo. And that's what's left after 3 days. You know, the big cats get it, right? And then the small cats and then the dogs and then the vultures and then the insects and there's not much left. That's really what happens in nature. When you see perfectly preserved fossils, billions of them all over the world, to me it screams flood everywhere. So that's scientific evidence. Now, as I said, I think that directly refutes the evolutionary age and the paradigm of dinosaurs existing millions of years ago. You have to appeal, and they are, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but you have to appeal to unknowns to explain that. Now, here's some theological evidence. Remember I said the word dinosaur is a modern word. You wouldn't see it in the Bible, but depending on what translation you read, you'll read about this creature in Job 40, verses 15, 18, called Behemoth. Now, remember, Job is having a difficult time, so at the end of the book of Job, God speaks to Job in creation passages. Were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you. What does he do? He eats grass like an ox. He's a vegetarian. Strength in his loins, force in the muscles of his belly. I don't know about that one, but to hold that big long neck up, he's going to have big shoulder bones with cradling huge muscles to be able to do that. The same with his hips to cradle that tail. Bones like tubes of bronze, like bars of iron. But you notice what he says there? He hangs his tail like a cedar. Now, presumably, Job lived in the Middle East, and so he would have been directing his attention, I believe, to the cedars of Lebanon. I've become a bit of a student about Egypt and Egyptian chronology. And, of course, the Egyptians didn't have a lot of native wood, and they sent expeditions out to what is now modern-day Lebanon and brought back cedar. They're great stands of trees. Now, you've got to be careful because even my modern translations in the study guide and study notes say it could be a hippo or an elephant. Okay, that's what Behemoth is. Well, there's some cedar trees as an example. Pretty impressive stands of trees, aren't they? And here we have this cedar tree-like tail. So here's a picture I took of a hippo out at Kruger. I don't think so. That's at Australia Zoo, Steve Irwin Zoo. The three wise elephants, not exactly like. So we have this cedar tree-like tail. So look at the giant size of the sauropod in relation to elephants and humans there. They're magnificent creatures, aren't they? I hope they're going to be in the new heavens and earth again because I really, really would like to see what some of these sauropods look like. So there are other creatures in there called Leviathan and so on and so forth, but it says about Behemoth there that he stands in the River Jordan with his mouth against the surge. So he's big enough to stand in a river that seems to be running pretty fast, perhaps even in flood. And then all over the world, we have depictions where I think people have seen dinosaurs. This is a Chinese jade dragon, and I'm not going to use Cambia nebulous, or maybe it is. I'm going to show you a handful that I think have incredible detail that I do believe they were depicting dinosaurs. Protoceratops. Here's a 16th century French tapestry. You see up in the corner there what's called Maiazura. Look at this. It's a duck-billed dinosaur. Got the right ear recesses, the right number of toes, etc. I said earlier this year I was in Cambodia, with the rest of the CEOs from the ministry for our international meeting, and we went to the temple of Tar Prom, and we found the wall here. Have a look. There's a person at the top. There's an antelope down the bottom. There's an iguana. And have a look at that. Anyone know what that is? What is it? Triceratops. See, you can know, you can tell what it is from the depiction. It's got the right horns on there, the bony plates on the back, and those carvings are 800 years old, etc. See, it all comes from Creation Magazine. Here's one we first featured in Creation Magazine in Carlisle Cathedral in the far north of England near the border of Scotland. This Anglican bishop, Bishop Bell, he was interred in 1496, and you can see the brass engravings that were inlaid in his tomb there. And by the way, there was no natural light at the back of the cathedral. We had to pull the rugs back. And guess what? There are creatures engraved in there, and you can easily recognize those. You can see the flash photography there. A bat, a fish. See, the dog's actually got a collar on. And then there's a bird. And then we have these two creatures. And they look like necking sauropods. I actually can say the word necking to Africans, and you know what I mean, because if you've been to Kruger, you've seen the giraffes necking, right? Etc., hitting each other when they're the necks. Why this is interesting, look at the one on the right. Look at his tail. It's just a plain tail. The one on the left has a split and a couple of spikes on his tail. And there's only two sauropods that had that. And one of them was Shunosaurus, which is why I put that name there. So we even get that level of detail. Below, it's not a dinosaur, but it looks like an amphibious reptile called Erops. They think it lived at the age of the dinosaur because we found it in dinosaur-bearing strata. I could go on. Unmistakable. The one skinny, long-necked dinosaur called Tanistrophius appearing here on a Mesopotamian cylinder seal. Now, there were a couple of these books left out the back. That's where it all came from. A friend of mine from Canada, Vance Nelson, went all over the world to different museums, picturing and photographing these artifacts. All came from that particular book. If Robert has sold out at the back, you can pay and for that book today, and he will ship it to you for free if we've actually run out, all right? So we only carry a limited range on ministry. Even in Australia, Australian Aboriginals, all their stories are passed down orally. They actually didn't have any written language, and they've depicted a lot, obviously, in their artwork. Aboriginal art's become quite famous. And you look at this one here. See, there's people with their legs apart, spears pointed, and you can see why, right? Because one of their mates is in the belly there. And that looks like the shape, perhaps, of a plesiosaur. Now, a lot of those depictions we saw there were called dragons. And in historical stories, we have stories like St. George, the famous English knight who went and killed a hissing dragon. The flag of Wales has a dragon on it. Chinese pictured dragons, even pulling the emperor's chariots. And what I think, what we call our legends of dragons, I actually think are probably our dinosaurs of history. All around the world, the ancients seem to call these creatures dragons. Remember, the word dinosaurs, a modern word. So, question. I said dinosaurs were probably on the ark. It's a bit problematic, isn't it? I mean, how's he going to get a 60-foot Apatosaurus on the ark? I mean, here's Noah trying to get a picture of Stegosaurus on there. Well, one of the problems, ladies and gentlemen, is, and, you know, again, not trying to be disrespectful, but we often buy our kids these lovely picture books depicting the ark like this. Well, you know, how could Noah get all the animals on that leaky bathtub, right? And it's kind of reinforcing the idea that the flood and the ark is kind of a fairy story. Here's the side, 140 meters long. As I said, over 20 meters wide, nearly 20 meters high, three decks on it. You know, that box shape was modeled. There's a technical article, peer-reviewed article on our site where it was modeled by Korean naval architects in one of their big shipping test tanks, and they showed that it would have been very, very stable in huge seas. I mean, this giant ship actually didn't have to go anywhere, did it? Because there was nowhere for it to go at the time. It had the carrying capacity of 522 railroad cars of stock. And it's been reasoned that Noah probably only had to take about a maximum of 16,000 animals, about 8,000 pairs, of course, seven of some, on the ark. Could have fit all on one deck. There's a great technical book. I wouldn't recommend it for bedtime reading, that goes through all of what we think of the kinds of dinosaurs. So firstly, the first thing to realize is the ark was huge, big enough. Some dinosaurs were as small as a chicken. I said the average size, they reason, maybe about the size of a pony, something like that. But even all the big dinosaurs started off as eggs. So I'm not suggesting Noah took eggs onto the ark because he had to take animals capable of reproducing after the flood. That was the whole point, right? And I remember going to my very first creation meeting and somebody said, no, dinosaurs are on the ark, survived the flood. I thought my head was going to explode, right? And then he gave me this answer about teenage dinosaurs. That if they're like kind of reptiles today, before they're fully grown, reptiles are sexually mature. They can reproduce. Actually, humans can do the same too, right? So Noah could have taken teenage kind of dinosaurs on the ark and they could have reproduced after the flood. In fact, it's been borne out by modern research. Again, secular magazine, Nature magazine, looking at the growth rings of dinosaur fossils. Now, there's a couple of ways they measure this. There are growth rings, but they look at the density of bones. Young dinosaur bones are still not very, very dense. The older ones, all the porous material is filled in and it's dense. You can watch a TED talk by Jack Horner, the world's most famous paleontologist, on that on YouTube. But for example, if we looked at Apatosaurus here, what they were saying is it underwent a teenage growth spurt between about age 5 to about age 16, 17, putting on about 5,500 kilos per year. How'd you like to feed that as a family pet? All right. So you've seen there, you know, could have got on board the ark at age 4, the flood lasted for a year, disembarked age 5, and could have grown in the post-flood world. Would have been pretty tough in those early years until the world had to regrow. So I want to talk about something here to help us understand how we end up with all of the species of creatures today. Species is a modern word. The Bible doesn't use the word species. It uses the word kinds, what we call biblical kinds, an original dog kind. Have a look today. There are like 300 breeds of dogs. There are all sorts of different cat kinds around the world. And it all comes from programming in our DNA. DNA is that chemical hard drive in the nucleus of our cells. It's incredibly efficient at storing information. In human beings, in a single strand of our DNA, we've got about 3 billion letters. That's like stacking 1,000 Bibles worth of information on top of one another. And by the way, all those letters and 1,000 Bibles worth of information have got to be in the right place to tell the cells to build a human being, for example. It's been described as the most complex information storage mechanism in the entire universe. Now, boys and girls, you students in particular, I'm going to talk about something called natural selection. In my years of ministry, this is the number one stumbling block for you young ones. Because your professors, well-meaning, will stand up and they say, look, creatures change over time, therefore evolution is true. Creatures do change over time, but it's not evolution. I'm going to show you natural selection is actually part of the creation model. The first thing we need to understand about evolution, we have to get from simple to complex. All life arose from some simple organism in a warm pond on Earth maybe 2 or 3 billion years ago. The simplest organism on the Earth today is a bacterium, has 500,000 letters of information, right? Human beings have 3 billion letters. So natural selection, okay, has to create new structures, new information to get the variation of creatures that we see on the Earth today. Now, Darwin actually believed dogs, he was a pigeon breeder himself. He had all these different species of pigeons. But to be honest, he would have known there were limits to the changes that he could breed. But I'm going to use dogs here because we're all familiar with dogs. And I'm going to start off with this parent kind of couple of dogs. And I want you to imagine they've got medium length fur, right? Middle length fur. Now, those things that we've pictured in the chest, they're genes. So a gene is a set of instructions. So the dog on the left here, he's got a gene, gene for short fur and a gene for long fur. Mum's got a gene for short fur and a gene for long fur. They've got all the genetic information necessary, you're going to see, to produce differing lengths of fur in their offspring. So they get married, walk down the aisle, have puppies, and we can end up with dogs with short fur. So what happened? Well, remember from your biology classes, what do? We get one set of instructions from each of our parents, right? So this guy here, he inherited the short fur gene from dad, and the short fur gene from mum, so he ended up with short fur. You can get dogs in the medium range, short fur gene from dad, long fur gene from mum, vice versa, long fur gene from dad, short fur gene from different combination of the genes, but notice they're still, it's still expressing in medium length like the parents. And then we can get this critter. What happened there? Well, she only inherited the set of instructions for long fur from each of her parents. But notice we've got change in one generation. All right, happened very quickly. But here's the thing. Has anything new been created? No. There's still dogs. There's been a sorting out of genetic information. But guess what? It can only arise from information that was already present in the population. Nothing new has been created. Now, living in America now, I've done three ministry trips up to Alaska. One of them was in winter. Wow, what an amazing place for an Aussie who mainly lives in the deserts to go to. Okay, but I want you to imagine you have all these dogs in a country, a state like Alaska, right? And it gets really cold. Which ones have a survival advantage in cold climates? The ones with long fur. So nature selects. Haha. Be careful. Nature's not some conscious living entity. It's just a convenient term to describe what happens in nature. Creatures without a favorable survival trait, okay, are going to get culled out. Now, when these dogs reproduce, what will happen? They'll only reproduce dogs with long fur. They've adapted to their environment. So first thing I said, nothing new has been created, but there's a big problem for natural selection being the mechanism for what they call macroevolution, the big changes, you know, pond scum to people type evolution, because we've now lost genetic information from the population. Can you see that? They're adapted to their environment, but it's a loss of information. And that's mainly what we see. Evolution's Achilles heels. 15 PhD scientists who are experts in this very area, showing you that the very beliefs within the evolutionary model do not have the power to create. Listen, so there's no misunderstanding. We love science. Real science shows that evolutionism, right, a belief system, is not how it works. We've got no problem with science. Real science shows here that it's the opposite of what evolution requires. Natural selection does not work. Now, I want you to think post-flood, okay? What happens is creatures are going to move into these new environments all over the world. There's some hot, there's some cold. And there's always going to be a variation within population. Look at the variation within the humankind I'm seeing today. And we even see that among humans, selection working. So look at these guys. I mean, they're both dogs, if you can call chihuahuas dogs, but anyway. Now, technically, it would be possible for them to interbreed. I mean, you'd probably have to artificially inseminate the chihuahua, but her DNA would control the birth size. Okay? Now, I would suggest, I think if we had not seen them alive today and we'd found their fossils in the ground, they'd probably say they were separate species. That's probably what they'd say. So, and we know, and the reason I use dogs is we also know that if we closely breed dogs, what happens? We get inbreeding effects, right? Because the same mutations, the same copying mistakes are going to match up from each from the information we get from the parents. And what we see in nature all around us is mutational load building up, good getting worse. It's called genetic entropy. It's happening in humans. We inherit from our parents and our sexual reproduction cells about 50% of all the mutations that they had. And we've added a minimum of 100 letter mistakes of our own. And then guess what? Our children inherit ours, we inherit out our parents, and they add about 100. Every generation of human beings is becoming more mutant. Now, the problem with natural selection, I want to point out here, is it can't see them. So let me explain. You know, in Kruger Park, if an antelope is born with a mutation that gives it three legs or five legs or whatever, it's going to get selected out pretty quickly, isn't it, by the lions? Doesn't have a survival advantage. But when it comes to just letter mistakes in us and organisms, they're so small, nature can't see them. Natural selection can't see them. So there's no way to reverse them. And John Sanford, and as I mentioned, and creationists showing that this is real science, ladies and gentlemen. It's the opposite of what we're seeing with evolution. We're not getting onwards and upwards. We are degenerating. And the bad news, you know what? There is actually no hope for the human race unless the Lord comes. Unless the Lord comes. But I have a very disturbing picture today. It's of an inbred dog. Do you want to see it? Yes? You're gruesome, aren't you? Okay, so here we go. Here's an inbred dog for you. All right. Poor thing. So lions and tigers are called separate species. Now, so be careful, because you can breed and select and you can get something that will no longer interbreed with the parent population it comes from, and they will call it a new species. Boys and girls, be careful when you hear the word new. Speciation is real, right? Environment and so on, as I say, can select for certain traits. Information heads in the wrong direction. They might call it new, but actually nothing new has been created. So just be careful of the terminology, all right? By the way, every member of the cat family can interbreed. Do you know that? Shows they came from an original created kind. Now, sometimes you're going to say, yeah, but Gary, there are hybrids and they're infertile. Not all hybrids are infertile. When you watch the documentary, The Voyage That Shook the World, marine iguanas on one island in the Galapagos, land iguanas in another. Marine iguanas swim in the ocean, eat seaweed, swallow seawater, expel the salt through their nose. Incredible. They're interbreeding. We actually have the head of the Darwin Research Station, Brian Milstead. He kind of says, they shouldn't be doing this. They're separate species. Well, who told them they were separate species, right? Humans. Are there such things as races? Well, culturally there might be, but genetically, no. We now know that you could fit all the diversity of human beings on this planet within an original human couple. The Bible has always said, of one blood, of one man, he made all nations of men. Okay? It was Darwin who developed the idea that the so-called dark-skinned races, he thought, were inferior. And you've almost got an obsession, unfortunately, in this country, the government, of trying to be the cradle of humankind, you know? And unfortunately, all the anthropological books still, you know, produce that ascending of column of man. And guess what they have? As more primitive, they have the dark-skinned races in there. You can read articles on our site. I went to the Smithsonian 2 years ago, and it's still there. Those ideas are still there. And yet we know that the racial differences between all humans today is less than 1%, or the genetic differences amongst the races, I should say. So this was one of the most popular articles we ever featured in Creation magazine, the two-tone twins. And there's the parents. See, nothing funny going on, but guess what? The parents are in the medium range of skin shade. You know, all humans, we have the same skin color. There are not different colors. It's a brownish pigment called melanin. We all have it. Codes for our shade of skin, shade of hair, shade of eyes. Is that white face there? Yeah. Okay, maybe I'll hold up the plate here. Take my food off. You can see that plate here is white. See, I mean, am I white? No, I'm not. See, I'm light brown. Some of you here are mid-brown. Some of you here are dark brown. We all have the same skin color, different shades of it. But guess what? In hot climates, lots of melanin is a survival advantage. In Australia, where the country's full of South Africans now, right? But in Australia, we actually are not allowed to send our children to school without a hat because we have the highest rates of skin cancers in the world. No hat, not allowed to go out and play. We're obsessed with sun protection in Australia. So just imagine when Captain Cook, you know, arrived there in 1788, he found lots of dark-skinned Aboriginals. Now, I'm sure after the flood, lots of fair-skinned people like me probably moved there. But guess what? We get skin cancers, we die, we don't pass our genes on to the next generation. Lots of dark skin is a survival advantage in hot climates. It's selection. Simple genetics that we understand today. By the way, there's the girls all grown up. So we have these modern varieties, zebras. It's nice to say zebras and not zebras again. Okay. Just a variety of horse, lions, tigers, different, you know, breeds of cows. Camels and llamas will actually interbreed. You know, killer whales and dolphins can interbreed. Look at the variation within a created kind that we see. So we have these modern varieties we call species. What were the original kinds like? We don't know. And that applies with dinosaurs. So remember I said there was these bone wars and they were picking up fossils and giving them new species names? So here's an example. Three species of dinosaurs, Dracorex, the Gymaloc, and Pachycephalosaurus. But do you know now what they know? It's the same dinosaur at different stages of growth. They found their fossils, just fragments. Jack Horner, the world's most famous dinosaur paleontologist, he suggests that one-third of all the named dinosaur species may never have existed, that are merely different stages in the growth of other known dinosaurs. Here's the one that's very famous, Triceratops. We've all heard of that. And they now think that these 11 species are actually the same dinosaur from the Ceratopsia family. And you can see the different variations, different skull, bones, horns, and so on and so forth. So they've gone really from about 200 species of dinosaurs, we would say as creationists, down to about, 50 distinct kinds. About 50 distinct kinds. Now keep in mind, right, 50 dinosaurs, that's 50 kinds, that's 100 that go on the ark. Some are small as a chicken, and even the large ones, Noah could have taken teenage dinosaurs on the ark. Not such a problem. There are ways of solving this. But we all want to know what happened to them. Are they alive today? I don't think so. I don't think we're chances of finding any, because I think even if they did stumble across a few humans in the last few hundred years, guess what we're going to do? We're going to kill them. Yeah, it's interesting. In America, I tell them often about my trips to South Africa, and I say, you know, you watch all those wonderful wildlife documentaries, and I say, but you know, all those animals you watch, you know, lions hunting down zebras, it's all happening in parks, isn't it? Now, why are those animals in parks? For our protection? It's for their protection, isn't it? And you know, even in India now, they're trying great efforts in conservation, but there are still wild tigers, and they walk into someone's village and grab one of the kids, and then there's a hunting party out to kill the tiger. So after the flood, I think it's possible that animals probably went after unnatural prey, probably human, but I think more likely a nice triceratops like that, well, he's going to feed your family for a couple of months, isn't he? And do you know if he's the last one on Earth? I mean, we didn't have TV cameras in every corner of the world. We weren't counting them, and he probably really didn't care anyway, if survival is the main concern. So what can we learn from this today? Well, when we think about Job, again, God was directing him. Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you. That was something Job could wrap his mind around. Yeah, maybe he was looking at one of those giant sauropod dinosaurs and pondering the incredible creative power of God. You know, in John 10:9, the Lord Jesus says, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in, go out, and find pasture. You know, that's kind of analogous to what we read at the time of the flood. It says the animals going in, male and female of every living thing, as God had commanded Noah. And then the Lord shut them in. That's very significant, isn't it? Noah didn't close the door behind him. The Lord shut him in. I think that's giving us that sense of finality that it's too late. And I said earlier in the New Testament, 2 Peter 3:5, it actually warns us that people will be willingly ignorant of the flood. Deliberately forget, but long ago, God's word, the heavens existed, the earth was formed out of water and by water. It had a watery origin, not a hot, molten Big Bang. By these waters, also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. You know, if there really was a global flood, what do you think the evidence would be? Thousands of meters of sedimentary layers with fossils in them. What do we find? Thousands of meters of sedimentary layers with fossils in them. Now listen, when I point this out, don't think I'm talking conspiracy or whatever. The heart is deceitfully wicked above all things. That's the problem. Sin is the problem, ladies and gentlemen. I think evolution's a great excuse to say there's no God, so I can do what I want with my life. That might be how some think. But the Bible tells us that is the case here in some cases. And the Lord Jesus also says, just as it happened in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, being given in marriage. In other words, living their lives as if God didn't exist until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It's pretty sobering, isn't it? Do you know, we look at the age of the patriarchs. They lived for hundreds of years. Remember I said I think there's a genetic reason. We get this genetic bottleneck at the time of the flood. But Noah was 600 years old before he had children. So imagine somebody who lives to 90 today. That's like being in your 60s before you have kids. You know what would happen? You're passing lots of mutations onto your offspring the older you get. Lots of aged DNA, in other words. And so Noah, he lived 300 years after the flood. So the environment suddenly didn't become super toxic after the flood. That's what creationists used to believe. So again, our models, we try to correct, but our paradigm doesn't change. We hold to the Bible fast, hold to models loosely. Okay? That's what will happen. That's genetic entropy. We see a sharp decrease in lifespans after the flood. But think about it, living for hundreds of years, I wonder how many children they had. So creation scientists estimated, and these are the extreme ends, right, that as few as 500,000 people, up to 2 billion, and we don't think it's that much, but that's the range you could get with people living for 100 years, maybe having a child every 2 years, something like that. And how many people survived the flood besides Noah and his family? Besides Noah and his family, none. Wow. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? Now, maybe you've been brought along by a Christian friend, or you're just curious, and maybe you're not sure if you are a Christian today. There is a serious message. We're having fun, but there is a serious message to all of this. The Bible actually talks about a coming judgment, not by flood, but by fire, before the new heavens and earth. So I have to ask, are you sure that you're on the ark of salvation that is Jesus Christ? Because the ark in Noah's time was an ark of salvation to save him from the flood. The next ark is the Lord Jesus. And you know what? It's not anything I do or the leaders and the pastors here at the church do, but it's everything the Creator did himself to make a way to reach out to us. Why would you not accept that free gift of salvation and be reconciled with the Creator of the universe, the stuff we're discussing today? I think that's incredible. See, the Bible is the history book of the universe. But this history book not only tells the past, it tells the future. And God can do that because he is outside of time as we know it. So that's a snapshot. Looking at dinosaurs again, our website has tons of information. I mentioned evolution's Achilles heels. In all my years of ministry, this is the most powerful antidote to evolution I've ever come across. The DVD has 15 PhD scientists. The book is more technical. And as I said, it deals with the icons of evolution, natural selection, the geologic record, cosmology, genetics, chemical evolution, right? All of those categories. And as I said, they look at what evolutionists claim to see whether it actually has the power to create as they believe. Very, very well done. It's not a polemic, just deals with the science. And Rob says if you get the book and the DVD together, he'll give you a discount. These next two books are some of my favorite books, and I'm saying that because when you look at it, you think it's a kid's book. I had a PhD biologist write to me and said he learned something from this book on geology. Okay? This grasshopper guy, there's cartoons, there's exercises in there, but you will, if you do this with your families, you will learn a lot about geology. Geology is the number one culprit for millions of years. So this is a way of putting the right glasses on our kids. There's a companion book there on dinosaurs as well. I mentioned the dragons book. Now when somebody says to you, no real scientist believes in creation, well, as I said, our ministry employs a lot of them. But here's a book with 30 PhDs who are experts, obviously, in their fields. It's broken into categories of biology, genetics, geology, and so on. Some of them world-leading inventors like Dr. Raymond Damadian, who invented the MRI technology that obviously is used worldwide. So showing you their specialty, discussing it, how and why they became Christians. A brand new book, and I think one of the nicest books we've ever produced, is A Question of Origins. And this is high school kind of curriculum. So stuff you can do with your teens, teaches about worldviews, goes through all the scientific disciplines. I believe you had Andy Mack here not long ago talking about design. good friend of ours, Dr. Stuart Burgess, his brand new book, Inspiration from Creation, How Engineers Are Copying Design in Nature to build their machines, etc.